You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 28th of August 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show. French President Emmanuel Macron appears powerless to stop his disapproval ratings rivaling those of Louis XVI. Could a foreign policy success turn his young presidency around? My guests Alastair Bunkle and Murray Bion will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including the attempts by FARC to make the transition from guerrilla group to political party, the chances of a third round of Brexit talks being the first round to decide anything, and
we don't change. We take the gravel and the shell and we make a pearl, and we help other people to change so that they can see more kinds of beauty. And to all the artists here, I'm so inspired by all of you. Thank you for being your true selves.
A music awards ceremony runs short on praise for the US president. Could Donald Trump inadvertently inspire a new conscience in popular culture? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Alastair Bunkle, defence correspondent for Sky News, and Murray Bion, a UK correspondent for French media. Welcome both. We will start tonight with French President Emmanuel Macron, who, after a little over 3 months in office, is already perched on that thin line dividing the merely embattled from the downright beleaguered. As he prepares to host a major summit to discuss the migrant crisis, one recent poll finds that fully 57% of French voters class themselves as dissatisfied with his presidency, dramatically up from an already perilous 43% just 1 month ago. Murray, what has President Macron done to annoy 14% of voters in the last month? I mean, it's apart from anything else, it's August. Everybody's on holiday.
No, well, but he's been doing a lot. That's the main problem. And that's what the communication at the Elysee Palace wants to put forward. We've been taking risks, and that's why things are not going very well for the president. Contrary to François Hollande, who was accused of not doing a lot of things, and that was the reason why he wasn't popular, Macron wants to take the other road and make a lot of things. Of course, do a lot of things. And of course, French people are quite adverse to change. Although they might vote for reform, they're not really happy when the reforms are shown to us, to them. And Emmanuel Macron has been trying to do quite a lot, especially for the changing the labour laws, which is of course something very sacred for the French people. And even during the summer, I guess they were following what was happening, especially because he wants to change them very quickly using executive orders. But of course, there's also a few missteps that he's done. I mean, for example, he wants to change the housing benefits, and he wanted to give a new status for for the First Lady. At the same time, he was trying to prevent MPs to hire their wife, which is exactly what he wanted to do himself, and he wants to cut the wealth tax. So there's a few things that didn't work here and there. It's very touch and go. It's basically finding his feet at the same time as trying to do a lot of things. So it's bound to be not too popular, although it's quite surprising how unpopular it is, I think.
Alastair, as Mari points out, Macron's predecessor was disliked because he didn't do anything. Macron is disliked apparently because he's trying to do too much. Is there any pleasing the French electorate? I'm going to indulge you as an Englishman here to enjoy one of your people's favourite pastimes, which is making sweeping generalisations about your good friends across the English Channel.
Well, the French are a volatile bunch.
Well done.
And, you know, I wouldn't, if I were Emmanuel Macron or one of his advisers, which looks as I'm not going to be after that comment, I wouldn't worry a jot about the polls yet. He's been in the Elysee Palace for a matter of months. It's fairly typical for a new leader to come in and either to disappoint in the first instance or to sort of ride a slightly artificial bounce from an election win. You know, he has a challenge ahead of him. They are just entering Rentrée Politique, which is this kind of, well, annual event, isn't it, where essentially the opposition and the government come back and he has to assess the months ahead, and they are difficult months ahead. They have been difficult months that he's gone through initially. I mean, clearly this sort of young, good-looking, charismatic leader has come onto the stage and realised that things, once you're in office, are not as easy sometimes as they always might seem from the outside. And he's taken on the military and, well, I wouldn't say he's necessarily lost, but a general has very publicly resigned. The head of the army has publicly resigned as a result of planned cuts. And clearly what is that sets the tone for a very hard few months ahead, and the reforms that he wants to drive through are not going to be easy. I think France is a very hard country to ever reform.
Well, indeed so. But one of the things he is attempting to reform, Mari, and this is the summit that he is calling, which is including leaders of various other European countries and leaders of some of the African countries, which are functioning as transit points for these unceasing migrant inflows, specifically Niger, Chad, and Libya. How big a story is, obviously the migrant crisis dominates the countries in which it is an obvious frontline issue for reasons of geography, particularly Italy and Greece, to a slightly lesser extent Spain. How big a thing is it in France?
Well, we haven't forgotten Calais, of course.
Well, indeed not.
It's a bit disappeared in the media, but it's still very much there, and there's still people trying to come back to Calais. Indeed, almost every, I wouldn't say perhaps every day, but every week there's a feature in the radio, television, newspaper, something on Calais, something on people coming back to Calais. So it's still very much in the mind of the people. The international issue and the way it's being dealt with may be perhaps a bit further away for French people, because it's been so a local, a national issue for so long that the idea that it's a major international issue is perhaps somehow a bit lost on some people in a way. But what Macron wants to do is he wants to show that Calais, even if it's rebuilding itself somehow, it's not because of the French or what they do or don't do. It's because there's a wider international canvas, and that's why people still want to focus on Calais to go to England, and in particular. And this summit is really there. It's a communication tool as well, because of course it's indeed la rentrée politique, so he wants to be seen as doing something, and a president, historically French president, are well received when they have an important role to play on the international stage. That's him on the international stage, and he's hosting, so that's quite important. I mean, that's something that's good for the moral of the French, to be the host of this kind of summit. And he wants to be seen as the one who's doing the thing, or pushing the other countries to do things. And he's, for talking about the misstep that he did in the summer, or since he's been elected, one of the missteps he did is talking about hotspots in Libya without consulting Libya, for example, about a hotspot. He might want to, you know, change of tack for that.
Alistair, this is Macron's big idea about the migrant crisis, which he has floated before, this idea of hotspots to process people before they make it to the shores of the Mediterranean and therefore take the dreadful risks associated with making that crossing. But he's talking about including these transit points in Libya and also Niger and Chad. Now, is there any way at all imaginable this can be done without a fairly hefty military deployment to all three of those countries?
I think that's the mistake he made. It showed some naivety on his part. And whilst trying to tackle the migrant crisis, I think, is a popular move in France, and get it right and it will go down well with the electorate. The problem is his execution has not been good. He hosted a summit, I believe, a couple of months ago and forgot to invite the Italians. Well, the Italians are right at the forefront of the policing of the Mediterranean and also liaising with the Libyans. They've had some success trying to liaise with the Libyans to prevent people from leaving Libya to go to Italy. So Macron then, you know, blasts out this policy about creating hotspots and safe zones in Libya, but, as you say, doesn't consult the government. And it's a non-starter, and it sort of gets laughed at a bit. And whilst I think there is some substance to what he's trying to say, it's not really being... It's the PR he's not getting right. He's not thinking about it. It's not being thought about deeply enough, and it's not properly actionable.
So, Mari, just a final thought on this. Aside from whatever success he may have via this summit on the migrant crisis, what other options does he have for trying to improve his numbers? Because it's not just a question, if you're a politician, especially one newly in government, of satisfying your vanity. It's political capital, good popularity ratings. It means that you have greater options. There's more you can do. People take you more seriously.
Well, that's not going to be very serious when I'm going to start with, but I guess reducing his makeup bill would be a long way.
We talked about this last week, €26,000 in 3 months on makeup.
Yes, and
this
we don't know how
about,
much...
This is the point about PR versus yes. actual substance, style versus substance. And, indeed. I mean, he clearly has the look, he has the swagger of an international leader, and he slightly seduced the world in a way Justin Trudeau did, for example, in the way that Tony Blair did. But it's the actual substance of leading, and I think that's where he's coming short at the moment.
And that's maybe because he's a newcomer in politics. He's completely new. He's held office before, but not so long ago. I mean, 5 years ago, he was just nothing in politics. Well, not in the forefront of the scene anyway. So he's doing the mistakes he would not perhaps have done if he had held office for a longer time. He's a newcomer, and he said he wouldn't do the mistakes because he was you know, accompanied by a lot of people who had a lot of baggage in politics. But he's very much his own man, and maybe he doesn't listen to the right people or doesn't want to listen to people where they tell them, well, they tell him, maybe you should do that because that's the way things are done in France. He's known to say, well, that's not because things are done this way that I should do it this way. I'm going to do it my way. And perhaps French people being a bit complicated to please, that's not working.
It's not my show, but can I ask Marie a question as someone who knows France better than I do? I said France is a country that's impossible to reform. I mean, when we're talking of labour reforms and reductions in public spending, is that possible in France? Does it need to happen, and will he be successful ultimately?
Does it need to happen? I do think that, yes, it does need to happen, because unemployment is very high, especially for young people. And it is true that bosses are a bit reluctant to employ people because it's so hard to get rid of them if they're not doing a good job. And so that's something that has to change for employment to flow a bit more easily. And there's this culture that work is something that you go because you have to. That's something that Macron wants to change. He wants people, in a way, to see work as something that you can do for some time, and then you go to another employment, and then another employment, and it's good for you, just your general well-being. At the moment, is I have a job, I'll stay, whatever happens, even if I get a bit bored by it, at least I have a job. And that's something that, of course, is doing a lot of harm to France.
Okay, well, let's take a look now at Colombia, which has been kind of a good news story of late, having brought to an apparent conclusion more than half a century of war between the state and the narco-Marxist guerrilla group which traded as FARC. Making that peace was not easy, but now comes what might be the really tricky bit, which is helping FARC to remake itself as an orthodox political party and persuading Colombia's public to accept it as such. Alistair, FARC is having its first post-peace congress today. This includes talk of rebranding, giving itself a new name, which will come as a massive relief to everybody who's ever had to pronounce its acronym on the air. You do have to be extremely careful with that one. A couple of names floated are New Colombia and the Alternative Revolutionary Force of Colombia. Do either of those have possibilities, do you think?
Well, we don't know what the name's going to be yet, and FARC is, you're right, if you're an English language speaker, is one that you always approach with some trepidation, but I suppose it does have international recognition, and there's a lot to be said for that. Okay, it is an infamous name rather than a name that is associated with good. It is a name that is associated with a violent struggle. It is a name that is associated with terrorism, but it is a name that people recognise. And whilst FARC, in light of the peace process, want to rebrand, and everybody would, I'm sure, welcome a move into politics and away from violence, I think if I was a sort of a marketing strategist, I wouldn't necessarily want to see the back of the name FARC that quickly. But again, we come back to what we're talking about with Macron. I mean, what is in a name? It's all about style. What FARC need to do in this conference is they need to put forward some policies. Why should the country support them as a political entity? Because the polls suggest that Colombians are not particularly behind this idea of FARC being in politics. So what they really need to do, regardless of changing their names and their identities, is prove themselves to be a serious and grown-up and believable political party.
Murray, how tricky is that going to be for them? As Alistair correctly points out, a lot of Colombians have extreme reservations about this peace deal. Indeed, the first version of the peace deal was voted down at referendum. There's a lot of people who don't really see why FARC should be forgiven their crimes to the extent that they have been. Where is the balance between, you know, agreeing to waive a certain amount through in exchange for peace, and making sure people who've done the wrong thing are appropriately punished?
Well, I don't know if I'm right to think about that. I guess being not British, I can think about that with less feelings that perhaps Alistair can think about it. But it makes me think about the Good Friday Agreement in Northern Ireland, for example. Then the referendum was won and the agreement was accepted by the people. But the idea was also that people who committed crime, they were allowed to get out of prison or not to be judged for their crime. It's the same for the FARC over there. They'll be allowed to get out of prison, or they'll just have to confess their crime to a peace tribunal, but they won't have to pay the price for their crime. That's something that's, at some point, as we've perhaps seen in Northern Ireland, peace has to be basically put first, and even if it's very hard for some people, someone has to basically bite the bullet and say, okay, bad people are around, but if we accept them and see what they have to say non-violently, although it's very hard to hear what they have to say, perhaps in a few years' time, it's just going to be normalised, and FARC, in the way they're going to exist, may still exist in a few years' time. Maybe there'll be just a little party. Maybe there'll be a bigger party. Maybe they just won't have any reason to leave. But it's a process that I think Colombians have to go through, although it must be very, very hard.
I mean, Alistair, are there lessons, do you think, from Northern Ireland? And again, Northern Ireland looks extremely different rather from inside Northern Ireland than it does elsewhere in the United Kingdom. But is there a similar setup or a similar dynamic at work?
Well, I mean, in so much that the IRA were the armed wing of Sinn Féin, they have all but laid down arms, and Sinn Féin now are a relatively successful political party in so much that they have seats in the Republic of Ireland, they have seats in the Northern Irish Assembly, or what currently exists of the Northern Irish Assembly right now, and they have seats in Westminster, although they don't take them up. And so they have managed, through their political wing, to have some influence in various different spheres of Irish or Irish-related politics. And so I think you would say, if you were Sinn Féin, that has been a rather successful move. I mean, I was doing my research before this, trying to find out examples of other terrorist organisations that have laid down arms and taken up a more mainstream political direction. And the one that seemed to keep on popping up, and this isn't, you know, I'll clarify this in a second, but is Hezbollah, which has a political movement. Now, of course, they've also got an armed faction to them that is very active.
They've got an actual army, really. It's beyond an armed faction.
Yeah, which is very active around the Middle East and pretty disruptive around the Middle East. But whilst it is classified a terrorist organization externally, within Lebanon, they are considered a political party. The other one that just, whilst Marie was speaking, sprung to mind, that was considered once a terrorist organisation but is now accepted as a mainstream political party and never rebranded, was the ANC in South Africa, of course. And I think you would say, and South Africa has its own problems, but that's a party that has fought a struggle, very, very different to what we're talking about in Colombia, but has fought a struggle and has managed to put itself right into the centre of mainstream politics in the country that it's always existed in.
OK, we're going to take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House with me, Alistair Bunkle, and Mari Bion. Coming up next, Brexit talks have resumed, so there is always someone worse off.
Monocle's dedicated network of international bureau and correspondents bring the best global stories to our readers and listeners. Our eagle-eyed team of editors and journalists staffing Bureau in Toronto, New York, Zurich, Singapore, Hong Kong, and Tokyo deliver the best content from the world's most important regions straight to the airwaves of Monocle 24 and the pages of Monocle magazine. We've also got boots on the ground in more than 30 cities worldwide thanks to our comprehensive correspondent network. It's for this reason Monocle brings an up-to-date, informed and engaging commentary from Brasilia to Brussels and from Sydney to Singapore. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You're back with Midori House with me, Andrew Mullister. With me are Alistair Bunkle, defence correspondent for Sky News, and Mari Bion, a UK correspondent for French media. Now, a third round of Brexit negotiations have begun today. To bring us up to date on where we are, a recap. The first round agreed that there would be a second round, and the second round agreed on a third. Chief EU negotiator Michel Barnier, keeping a commendably straight face, has suggested that progress thus far has been insufficient. Mari, first of all, UK's Brexit Secretary David Davis has said that both sides, as he puts it now, have to show flexibility and imagination. Isn't the problem that there is absolutely no reason why the EU needs to do anything whatsoever or make any concessions, really?
And just wait for the UK to present, to say very clearly what they want to achieve in this negotiation. Well, if you do that, I mean,
that's the attitude the EU is now taking. The UK has created this problem. It's up to the UK to solve it.
Well, yes. But, you know, there's this technique. If you want to put someone very ill at ease, you just let them talk. You don't say anything and you let them talk. And they keep on talking because they'll be so straight that you're not saying anything, not knowing what you're thinking.
Like I'm doing right now.
Exactly now, yes. And that's exactly, I think, what the EU perhaps is toying with, the idea they are toying with, because they thinking, well, if the UK leaves, if we arrive at March 2019 and we haven't decided anything, they're going to ask us to stay. So we'll have the upper end then. But I'm not sure that's exactly, I mean, at the start, I'm sure there was a lot of willingness in the EU to try and make things good with the UK in the hope perhaps that in the end they won't part ways and the UK will stay into the EU. But there was this attitude in the UK, this very political and aggressive attitude in the UK that they wanted to have something from the EU to basically just kick them in the sand and say, well, we're going now. The EU is a bit, showed itself at the start as a bit of the victim. They didn't have any say in the referendum, so they wanted to show themselves as, you know, the virgin being assaulted by the UK who wants to go away with the bounty. And now they are thinking, wow, if we keep on not saying anything, they're gonna imagine some very weird border custom issue, the Northern Ireland border paper was quite fanciful, I think Barnier said. So they see that
magical thinking, exact words.
Indeed, unicorns and all that, yes. So and it's somehow you listen to what the EU is saying and you think, well, they're having a field day. They're really making fun of what the UK is presenting. But at the same time, they have, in a way, all the right to do that because they want to have the clear sign from the UK from what they want. But each time the UK says what they want, it's not doable or it's fanciful. So at some point, I guess the EU will have to put its foot down and say, right, perhaps 4 days of negotiations a month might not be enough for such a huge undertaking that the Brexit negotiations are. Maybe if we were together a longer time, we'll have less time to plot on each side of the channel and we'll be a bit more serious.
Alistair, one of the things that strikes me about this is that the UK is supposed to be leaving the EU in March 2019, which is not that long. Well, people can count the months themselves. There seems to me to be a remarkable lack of work being done on things like new border posts and space being leased for all the new agencies that the United Kingdom will be to create and extra people being hired for an expanded customs force and so on. How seriously is anybody on either side really taking any of this?
Yeah, but you can't create office space for an agency that you don't know what exists.
Well, in theory, Britain knows it's going to need it.
Well, you can't know you're going to need something until you've set out what you're going to need. And the British negotiating position yet is currently so unclear that I'm not sure anybody could quite go as far, even in Whitehall, to say, and we're going to need this department and this department, because they're not, well, on the face of it, quite sure what it is they do want. But let me just, I'm not a Brexiteer, but let me just defend the British position for a moment. You know, it's not as if the EU doesn't need Britain. I'm not saying that Britain is the be-all and everything to the EU, but they are a big trading partner. They're a big security and defence partner. They're a big political ally. The EU cannot let Britain just walk away, and Britain cannot just walk away from the EU. Okay, of the two, Britain would probably be worse off. But I think the two need to find a negotiated settlement out of this for their own benefit and their own good. And the second thing I would say, for all this, you know, this is intense negotiation. It's no wonder that it's not going particularly smoothly, because negotiations never do, whether we're talking about mergers and acquisitions or whether we're talking about peace deals to bring to the end wars. In the early stages, and we are still in the early stages, things are always complex. The two sides differ on most of the points, and it's about a coming together over time. But I do agree with Michel Barnier, who said today, time is moving really quickly, and the British government, David Davis and the Brexit department, need to clearly lay out what it is that Britain wants. Because if they don't lay that out, well, you don't really know where to start the negotiations. And that is why Labour's move this week to say that they would remain a part of the customs union and the single market for a transitional period,
which may conceivably go on forever,
so as to avoid a cliff edge, is a good political move. Because at least it gives some clarity. It tells you what they would do. And at the moment, the Conservative government has failed to do that.
OK, well, finally tonight, last night, as you may have or may not have seen, MTV made its annual distribution of its Video Music Awards to an assortment of the kind of artists who get played on MTV. This meant, inevitably, that several musicians got to give speeches, and we may assume from the lack of furious, vindictive, self-pitying tweets from the Oval Office that President Donald Trump was not among those tuning in, because few, if any, honorees gave the impression that they intended to vote for him in 2020. Murray, does it make any particular difference to anything, do you think, if musicians make the predictable speeches that the musicians predictably made? It didn't stop George W. Bush getting re-elected, for example.
No, but if no one was saying nothing, that would be there would be a problem. So it might not change a lot what they say, but the fact that it's saying something, I think, is quite important. And, I mean, it's not the first time that artists are taking position on politics. I mean, John Baez and the Vietnam War, many artists in the 60s did the same, and they are regarded now as all the speeches they give are seen as having emboldened the people to perhaps think a bit more thoroughly about what's happening, feel more involved into what was happening. The fact that basically somehow artists are being seen so, you know, away from the normal life, but at the same time, when they're trying to talk about politics, they're not seen as, you know, very, you know, they're not seen as the smartest tools in the box somewhere.
The
fact that they think they have an opinion about that kind of makes people think, well, if they can have an opinion about that, I can have an opinion about that.
Having interviewed a great many musicians, I can attest that some are sharper tools, as it were, than others. But yes. I asked one of them, who has been on the receiving end of the shut up and sing argument more than once, Steve Earle, about this, who did make the excellent point that, as he put it, and I think I'm quoting him correctly, this idea that artists shouldn't comment on society, that's our job.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think if you're a very good musician, then, you know, your commentary comes in the form of your music and your words, and some have done that absolutely brilliantly. And I'm always slightly conflicted with this, because actors, actresses, musicians, they do sometimes want to make political stands, and I can never work out which side I fall on. But look, let me just give you some of these figures from the VMAs, OK? On TV last night, their ratings have dropped 6.5 million viewers. Not bad, though. Compare that, though, to the 62.8 million video streams that they clocked up on Facebook. Now, that is one hell of an audience they have. And whether we like it or not, and whether or not they do have a right or a duty to comment on politics, the fact is they have a huge audience. And politicians need to be aware of that. If there's one thing that is worse than artists commenting on politics, it's politicians trying to go on things like the VMA Awards and get down with the youth.
That almost never ends well. I'm struggling to think of anybody who's carried that off with...
Well, Corbyn, probably,
with any amount of dignity.
At Glastonbury. But
well,
then...
our definitions of dignity may vary. Murray, the irony here, though, is that Donald Trump clearly craves nothing more than to be acclaimed and popular among, you know, cool, hip, famous actors and celebrities. It still must drive him nuts that he's got to where he's got and they still all hate him, or indeed hate him all the more.
Well, isn't it why they more and more take the stage and talk about him? Because they know it annoys him very much. And I think that's emboldening the artist to talk and perhaps to have an opinion. Perhaps maybe, I think, like a lot of Americans, artists as well, perhaps they didn't have a lot of political opinion. But now with Donald Trump, you have to have a political opinion. And it's so overwhelming what's happening at the moment that you have to lash out somehow.
I think what they're really all hoping for is that he goes on Twitter and denounces them and their new record available in all good stores personally. I mean, it would send your sales through the roof.
All PR's good PR, isn't it?
Well,
no such thing as bad.
Indeed so. If you are listening, Mr. President, you would hate all of my books. That does bring us to the end of today's show. Alastair Bunkle and Mari Beyond, thanks for joining us at Midori House. Today's show was produced by Henry Rhys Sheridan, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Cy Villafuerte. Our studio manager was Claire Urban. More music next at 1900. Rob Bound is in with The Culture Show. I'm back with more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns tomorrow at 1800 London time. I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.